Thanks, Barbara, and good morning, everybody. I just wanted to thank Bruce and Yule for inviting me to speak with you all today. And I think there's a massive selection bias here, but I don't think I have to convince a lot of you that IT and automation are real keys for us in improving our processes, reducing errors, and improving quality. I do think we have an issue in laboratories about how we implement these things, how we use automation, how we use IT. And I think we can learn a lot from our industry colleagues in really implementing IT and automation appropriately. So I want to really look at some models of how this is done in industry and look at the history of automation in industries. I think it gives us some really good clues on how to implement automation and IT. So I think the future is bright if we do that. I think Dan Quayle captured this. The future will be better tomorrow. I have no idea what that means. You can always count on Dan for a good quote to start off a talk, I think. But I think it's real clear that system-level thinking is no longer optional. The time to prepare is now. If it hasn't started raining in your neck of the woods, it's going to rain soon. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark, but clearly the storm clouds are gathering, and we really have our work cut out for us. I think we have a ton to learn from industrial process engineering in order to really create not only high-quality laboratories, but low-cost laboratories. And what I'm going to sort of share with you is the experience that high quality really goes hand in hand with low cost. They're not incompatible at all. And in industry, this equation has been, you know, part of the equation for decades. You can't survive as an industry if you don't have a high quality, low cost product. But that hasn't filtered its way into medicine yet. So we'll look at the role of automation in IT in these two areas. So part of the title of my talk is Core Laboratories, just some definitions. What core laboratories are really combining all the laboratory medicine specialties. So blood, everything except the blood bank, really. So chemistry, coag, perhaps microbiology, perhaps molecular diagnostics, into one laboratory. And I think this is an important strategy, and this is a strategy that's been playing out for the last decade or so, because it really gives us the critical mass to specialize. We can hire business analysts, we can hire customer service specialists, and we can hire, importantly, IT specialists to get the important work of sort of dashboards, provider order entry, automation, all these tasks that no small lab is really going to be able to tackle. So automation. Automation's often, you know, one of the drivers for getting laboratories together. The figure is, you know, we can put everything on an automation line and make things better. We can bring hematology and chemistry and immunoassay all together. The important thing about lab medicine, though, is that it's complex. It doesn't lend itself very well to assembly line automation, and we really have to pay attention to information flows and analytics. And when we do decide to implement automation, do it in a very particular, standardized way. And I think industry, again, is going to show us the way how to do this. Medicine is clearly decades behind, considering our processes as manufacturing processes, but I think we have a lot to learn, and we can really put the tools in our hands to make rapid progress. So one of the tools that Dr. Hawker talked about a little bit yesterday is Six Sigma. And I have a friend who's actually the Six Sigma expert for a large supermarket chain. And if you think we measure a few things in our laboratories, you should see what Shaw's supermarket measures and how accurate their pricing is. That can of peaches that you buy, you know, is down at the 5 and 6 sigma level in terms of the accuracy of the barcode of the information. Hitting the target is all about what Six Sigma is all about. Deriving a specification and then doing PDCA cycles or some sort of statistical process control to get to that specification, to drive the defects per million down to somewhere near the Six Sigma level, you know, 3 defects per million opportunities. So where are we in healthcare? In healthcare, we're kind of at 2 sigma. We're kind of at the 80-20 rule. We get it right in most of our processes about, you know, 80% of the time. So about 300,000 errors or less well-handled specimens per million. Anesthesia, I have a lot of colleagues in anesthesia, and they're really down at the 5.2 sigma level. So how did they get there? And that's sort of deaths that are accountable to anesthesia, which was a huge problem back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. But they got there by adopting strict protocols, strict checklists. They got to 4 sigma. The real jump to 5 sigma came when they started monitoring end-tidal CO2, when they started monitoring pulse oximetry. So we have to figure out what is the pulse oximetry and PCO2 of a laboratory to get to higher levels of sigma. And as we'll see, it's not just an academic feel-good, less patient errors exercise. It's really a cost exercise. We're really reducing the costs of our operation when we reduce defects. Because these 300,000 defects are very expensive. And that's one of the biggest expenses, is fixing stuff, as we all know in our laboratories. So I think it's instructive to look at where this has gone in industry, from craft-style production all the way to sort of total quality production that we have now. So craft-style production is epitomized by Paul Revere looking pensively at this silver goblet that he's just created, John Singer Copley portrait there. And in craft-style production, a single person is involved with a product from start to finish. And in industries that employ craft-style production, you can recognize them because they have an apprenticeship, and they have very complex work. It's important that medicine, as we all know, is still referred to as the craft of medicine. However, if you look at competitive industries, craft-style production has been dead for almost a century. And what killed craft-style production was the rise of scientific management. So scientific management is also known as Taylorism in this field. And that's because of Frederick Taylor, an American mechanical engineer in the late 1890s, early 1900s, who was really the first to see the value of automation lines, what later got to be called automation lines. He saw production as a series of linked processes. And his real insight was to define the mass production methods and assembly lines that were used by Henry Ford and others to really usher in and really strengthen all the work of the Industrial Revolution and make it really pay off for consumers in the world. So prior to Taylor, most of the world was doing craft-style production. Within 2 decades, throughout the entire globe, craft-style production was dead. So this is actually a direct quote from Frederick Taylor, and he says, It is only through the enforced standardization of methods, the enforced adoption of the best implements and working conditions, and enforced cooperation that this faster work can be assured, and the duty of enforcing the standards and enforcing this cooperation rests with management alone. Sounds like a great place to work. This is top-down management at its best. So what Taylor and what he was dealing with was a very uneducated workforce at that time. Workers were essentially cogs in the machine, and that's how we're thought of. The engineers know best. Cap, Jayco knows best. They're going to tell everyone what to do. If we follow those directions, we'll do just fine. So very much top-down management. However, this didn't last very long. For very complex processes, the highly standardized assembly line approach really fails. And it would fail, I think, in healthcare as well, this approach. And the reason is just because of complexity. However, we didn't stop there. That was, failings in 1910 and 1920. What occurred is the whole series of tools that were developed, whether it be statistical process control, Plan-Do-Check-Act by Schuart in the 1940s, Deming in the 1950s, and then Lean or TPS models more recently. And these tools have enabled assembly lines to work and get better and get smarter in the face of very high levels of complexity. These were widely adopted by the Japanese industry in the sort of post-war period. This is a fascinating speech that Kensuke Matsushita, who was the founder of Matsushita Electric Company, gave to a group of American CEOs in 1980s. I think there was something lost in translation here. I don't know if he meant it to be quite this harsh, but you can imagine the reception. So we will win and you will lose. So he's talking to American CEOs. You cannot do anything about it. Your failure is an internal disease. Your companies are based on Taylor principles, which is amazing because Taylor principles were really defined in the 1890s. We have measured better than you the new technologic and economic challenges. We have passed the Taylor stage. We are aware that business has become terribly complex. Therefore, a company must have the commitments of all the minds of its employees to survive. Not to succeed, but just to survive. So what he's really talking about is worker participation and really the bottom-down theory of management, where you're paying attention to the frontline value-added processes is what you want to do. So I think you can all imagine what the response in the 80s was to this sort of thing. And it's sort of epitomized by Frank Borman. You know, I'm not going to have the monkeys running the zoo. So, of course, Eastern Airlines went bankrupt, blew up in the night. But this was the response. And so why was it the response? And why is it still the response in healthcare is what we're going to try to come to grips with today. So although most of the quality improvement tools were developed, these were all American engineers that developed these tools, they were widely panned, widely not used in American industry because we didn't have a lot of competition. And we had very much, you know, post-war complacency for many decades. And of course, this caught up with us, and we have adopted these tools since. The Japanese fully embraced these tools. They were rebuilding their industries after World War II, and it gave them a tremendous competitive advantage. Not just because they were able to build higher quality products, but because of the key finding that Japanese made, that quality controls cost. Building high quality automobiles, high quality television sets actually costs quite a bit less. And it has to do with reducing the number of defects per million. If you're not spending your money reworking things, if you're building it right the first time, less rework and scrap in sort of the manufacturing lingo, then you're actually building things much cheaper. And this was the big insight that has, you know, massive parallels to healthcare. So why hasn't U.S. healthcare adopted these tools in any meaningful way? We use them in very small areas. We do a lean project in a small, you know, very controlled part of our environment. And so what we're left with U.S. healthcare, as we all know, is very high cost, highly variable quality. So there can be very excellent quality in certain geographic regions. If you get hit by a bus, you want to get hit by a bus in this country. We do great rescue care in this country. We fall down on sort of routine preventative care, PCP, that sort of overall care. So when you look at overall measures of total health, the U.S. does very poorly. So why haven't we adopted these tools? It's been required for survival. I mean, Konosuke was saying, if you can't survive in industry and your companies are going to lose. So why hasn't this happened in the healthcare? Well, it's really lack of incentives. I think we all kind of know the answer. And it's been said in sort of the executive suite of healthcare organizations, I think my own, that quality improvement can be the path to financial ruin. And the reason for this is that the incentives do not support, you know, quality healthcare. The incentives are poorly aligned with quality outcomes. For outpatient testing in particular, the incentives actually encourage overutilization. We all know the MRI scans, the follow-up every 3 months for a benign cyst, the higher pay that you get for when you have a complication during surgery. There are a lot of ways that the incentives are really reversed. So something's going to change this. I think Jason Huang made a very good case that the traditional model yesterday is really not a tenable model and is really going to sort of blow up. So what's going to replace it? Is it going to be what he was talking about, I think, or what he feels may happen is really market-driven reform and consumer-driven reform, or will it be more top-down? Will it be, you know, more incentives for quality, another pay-for-performance targets? Will it be the two-tiered system or an Oregon model where we pay a good amount for procedures that we feel are justified, that the government feels are justified, and less for others, and that way set the incentive? Or will it be bundled payments? A lot of discussion has been around, can we figure out a way to bundle care and give you one payment as an insurer for the total inpatient and outpatient care of a patient? And that really flips the incentives. I think in some way, whether it be market-driven reform or bundled payments or the Oregon model or multi-tiered payments, clearly we're going to have to do more with less. And clearly, the incentives are going to be flipped. So we're going to be in a very different position. And I think it really makes sense to start focusing on quality improvement. It may not be raining now, but now is the time to build the ark. The financial incentives are already beginning to favor organizations that provide this sort of high-quality, low-cost care. And I think we have all the tools sort of in this room with IT and automation to get there. So I think another thing with quality improvement that it massively improves our professional role. As a manager of a laboratory, as directors of labs, I think managing expense reports is not something we enjoy doing. Managing quality is something we enjoy doing, and quality really controls cost. So if we can figure out a way to do this, we can satisfy the financial administrative groups in our organizations and satisfy ourselves that we're really focusing on the key things that make a difference to our patients. So the question is, how do we get there? So one of the sort of overarching question is sort of what is the role of an IT leader and a lab director in an organization? Is it, getting the right people? If I only had the right people, we could really, I need to shake things up and get the right people in the door. Is it motivating the people you have to do a better job? Is it setting management targets, setting aggressive targets for next year and stretch goals to try to get people to work? Managing frontline, managing the operating budget. Well, all of these, if you don't do these, you'll be in trouble, of course. But I think the overall, reason for being there is to, one, have a vision and then build infrastructure around it. And I think a lot of the infrastructure needs to be IT and needs to be automation. And I really think the goal of the leader is not to necessarily do all that other stuff. If you do this, if you make the right choices around infrastructure, the other stuff comes along with it. And the way it's done, and the way it's done in industry, is the way that we need to start doing things. Put in automation with attention to the frontline value-added processes. So Deming, I think, said it best, organize everything. This is his advice to the Japanese manufacturers that were rebuilding their industries in the 40s and 50s. Organize everything around your frontline value-added work processes. So the monkeys, in some sense, should be running the zoo, to reverse Frank Borman's quote. So the first step for every organization is really to identify your key value-adding processes. This is really something that takes some time, and it's different for a reference lab, it's different for a small hospital lab, and it's different for a multi-hospital laboratory system. And I think you have to really, when you're identifying your key value-added processes, you're identifying the data behind them. And you're building your data system based on the front line. And that's really a key point. You can't build your data system to support, CMS pay-for-performance goals. You can't build your data system from a top-down perspective. Building it according to what the JCO, CLSI, or CAP, thinks is important will, get you through your Joint Commission inspection, but won't do much for the quality of your care and the cost of your care. And those two things are intimately interlinked. So I think that's, an important point. So this was our partial list, our very high-level list, when we kind of got looking at our processes in our lab and figuring out what are our key sort of value-added processes. Where do we add value? Certainly order entry, and we placed a huge amount of emphasis on provider order entry. For every provider, we want to have an electronic order entry system. Patient ID, we want to use RFID and barcodes. Specimen collection, the same vein, we want to create a barcode at the point of origin of the specimen collection. Certainly having lots of customer service metrics, we know that's a big part of a laboratory is serving your customers, your clinicians in particular, for our customer service center, and then results reporting and critical value reporting. I think we have to take what we do in the laboratory and move well beyond the walls, looking at how people order the tests and, of course, how they result the test. And I think now is the time to really make that point in our laboratories. So we're going to design our infrastructure and data systems with whatever list we come up with for our operation. So every operation will have a slightly different list, but I think when you design and make infrastructure choices, you should be constantly kind of referring back to that list. Where are we adding value, and does this infrastructure choice make a difference? So the mantra is sort of the build your system by applications. And Yul made some great points yesterday about interoperability. And we actually totaled up how many interfaces we have at Partners Healthcare, and we have well over 2,000 interfaces that we are maintaining from instruments to instruments, from systems to systems. And it consumes we estimate about a third of the time of our entire IT department is just maintaining interfaces. So real attention, and I was really happy to see that there's some consortiums coming together to really think about interfaces in a very useful way. Because interoperability is still mostly a fantasy. You know, we have these syntactic standards where we know that OBX6 is the units of the, I know unfortunately the HL7 spec backwards and forwards, because it's really not a standard. It's a syntactic standard where stuff is supposed to be, but the stuff is all all blobs of text. It's not a semantic standard. It doesn't tell you what's going to be present in OBX6. So this is, you know, really something that has to be paid attention to when you're buying applications. So the other big rule about buying an application is the general principle, thou shalt not destroy clinical productivity. It's important to not do recreational data collection, as we like to call it. If you're going to collect data, it should be meaningful. It support your value-added processes. It should be something that's used every day, because then reality kind of shows you the way of how to use this data. So the central issues in any sort of data collection application, and the central issues for us when we put in order entry systems at partners, is, you know, is the paper-based thing that we're replacing worth the effort to make this electronic? As our far-flung outpatient clinics, is the effort that are only loosely affiliated with the hospital, is it worth it to put order entry systems in place? The other big issue and the big tension in electronic medical records is free text versus encoded data. So this is a huge issue where we want to get, of course, as much encoded data as we can. We want to know exactly what test code they're interested in. We don't want them to type in any free text at all. The problem is that any really complex system, you know, ordering lab tests is a pretty complex system. Evaluating the interpretation of a lab test is very complex. Any complex that's still usable system has some combination of free text and encoded data. So free text is kind of a necessary evil. I mean, SNOMED's wonderful, and SNOMED has over 1 million terms. So if you take 10 clinicians and ask them to look at this free text note and give me the SNOMED codes that are, you know, can be pulled out of this note, you'll get at least nine different sets of SNOMED codes. And there was actually a paper that actually showed that fairly recently. But I think when you build an application or buy an application, you have to make sure it really stands the test of the Pareto principle. So you design your system for the common and then use other methods such as free text for the uncommon. Making decisions like this, you know, really forces your hand at things you have to measure. So if you make a decision that free text is going to be okay, you're going to use free text, you better have a solution for monitoring your free text. So one of our key metrics in the laboratory is how many orders in our order entry system are done by a free text. If it's done via encoded data, you know, everything is good. We get a label printing out at the bedside. All the tubes get drawn correctly. They have the little, you know, this is a green 5 ml or a purple 3 ml. The process works flawlessly. We know that problems happen when free text is thrown in the mix. Things get interpreted incorrectly, drawn in the wrong tube. So if we're going to, you know, allow free text, and many of our systems have to have some level of free text, we have to have a strategy for monitoring it. So this we get every single day. We have a real-time report of what the percentage of orders in our order entry system are actually free text orders. So we can look at this. When we started our order, this is one our new inpatient order entry system that we started last summer. We were starting at a baseline. Our baseline, actually, before we were electronic, before we were, you know, linked and electronic, we had this electronic, very thin outer layer that looked electronic order entry, but it was actually a manual process behind the scenes. But once we were fully electronic, our free text percentage, we were very discouraged that it was about 10%. But since we were monitoring this, we've been able to, you know, send emails to the non-compliant physicians. These are mostly interns, so they listen to us. And we also have been able to really tweak the system. We've built the system in such a way that we can tweak the system behind the scenes, improve the searches, make it work better for the clinicians without getting IT involved. So we've been able to drive the free text percentage well below 1%. We're actually running at about a 4 sigma level now. So it's very rare that we get a free text order. Virtually all the orders that they need to find are found via search. But we would never be able to do this unless we had real-time monitoring. So we identified this as one of our key value-added processes, helping them pick the right test, and then we built our automation, data automation, and built our application around that idea. This is, I think, the kind of system-level thinking that we really need in our hospitals. One task that we did recently was kind of, let's take a step back at an inpatient care and look at the processes of care that go on throughout a hospital. So we identified three major sort of processes of care. The information-generating processes of care, and that would be virtually all the pathology services except for the blood bank, and are all generating information that has to be processed and managed. You lump in radiology here and diagnostic cardiology. The other group of processes of care would be the consumptive processes of care. The blood bank, the pharmacy, dietary are consumptive processes of care. And then there's lastly sort of the procedure or the protocol-driven processes of care. I think it really helps to lump yourself into this group because it kind of tells you kind of what to do next. So what to do next? Well, I think all three of these groups have already started forming alliances and started to think about results management together. And it's really due to the fact that the present reimbursement system rewards these groups, you know, quite handsomely. These are major sources of revenue, of course, for labs, radiology, and cardiology for many healthcare systems around the country. But I think as the incentives flip, whether it's due to market-driven competition or, you know, top-down government reform, all three of these are likely to be pure cost centers. And they really need to be managed that way, and we really need to think of them together. When you think of what goes on in these areas, they're very similar. I mean, we all have the same issues around order entry and decision support. The free text problem is the exact same problem you have in radiology and cardiology. Patient identification, generating the results, managing the results, all the same issues occur in these areas. And these are all the same areas which are exceedingly error-prone. So there are incredible medical legal implications here. As we learned yesterday, you know, diagnosis or communication, of course, I think we all know, is the number one cause of medical error, failures in communication, the root cause. Diagnosis-related error, this is sort of partners data, but is the same around the country. It's consistently in the top three categories of malpractice, so billions of dollars per year. 30% of cases are specifically related to receipt and transmission of test results. So just throwing that HL7 message across to our EMR is really not enough. I think we have to really step up there. Most of these errors, when you look, occurs at transitions of care or in the ambulatory setting, almost 90% of the errors. There's not as many errors on the inpatient side, even though a lot of the patient safety, you know, work is out on the inpatient side. And the errors are really rooted in the lack of robust systems to manage test results. And I would submit that this is really our job as one of the information-generating areas to help manage test results. So these are just a couple of errors that have occurred that I know of in the New England area. In our Risk Management Foundation actually publishes these on their website, the CRICO RMF website. And some of these occurred at some of our hospitals, some occurred at other hospitals in the area. One was a patient that came in with what all looked like gallstones. And yes, they had acute cholecystitis. They had their gallbladder removed. The CT scan at the time showed an incidental ovarian mass recommending follow-up. Follow-up was not done. That missed the boat with everyone worrying about the patient's gallstones. And 12 months later, the patient was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Another case, an elevated PSA. Never any evidence in the record this was reviewed by anybody. 2 years later, the patient developed widespread metastatic prostate cancer. 64-year-old man fell off a ladder, broke a rib, had a small rib fracture, seen in the emergency room, also had an incidental finding of a lung nodule, never followed up. Came back 2 years later with lung cancer. So all of these, of course, trigger massive interventions, error reports, safety reports, but is there a lot of evidence that that does any good? I think we've already had some evidence presented to us yesterday that voluntary error reporting systems are really completely inadequate for picking up on this stuff. They capture 1% of actual errors, and they may even be counterproductive. I think all of our institutions went through a lot of effort to prevent wrong-sided surgery, you know, because of a couple of cases, quite a long time ago. So billions of dollars were spent nationally around wrong-sided surgery, taking out the wrong kidney. Yet we have a 1,000 to 10,000-fold higher rate of preventable adverse drug events that continually occur in our organizations that don't receive the same focus. So shining the spotlight on one thing due to an error report really takes our eye off the ball and actually causes sub-optimization or really tampering with many of the other things we're trying to do. So diagnostic testing errors really have to be proactively screened. And I think if we build our data systems with the front line in mind, we have plenty of data to not wait for a safety report to start improving our systems. We have all this order entry data. We know how much free text percentage they're using. We know about mislabeled specimens. We know about amended report. We know about wrong tube types. We have all these reports that are used in different parts of our organization, but they really need to flow into the real strategic plan for the organization to have an effect. And I think the reason we need this sort of this core laboratory of the system level thinking, because that's really the only time you get the critical mass of individuals and expertise to really tackle these problems in a meaningful way. So this is a project that we've been working on for the last year or so to track test results. So the traditional laboratory model of test results is you order a test, we do the analysis in the lab, and we report the results. Maybe we make a critical value call, but generally we just send it over to the EMR and kind of hope for the best. What this result tracking system is designed to do is really take steps 4 through 8 and make them, make the lab really accountable, make the result generating areas accountable that these steps get done, that the result gets acknowledged by the provider, that the result is interpreted correctly by the provider, it gets communicated to the patient, clinical action is taken, and follow-up testing is pursued. So really changing the way our EMRs work from very much a sort of looking at results, results viewers, to activity-based EMRs. And I think Intermountain Healthcare is rolling out their version of an activity-based EMR in the next couple of years. And I think it's going to be really instructive to look at organizations that are paying attention to these steps. Because I think this is the step, this is the lack of communication, this is the root cause of most medical error that we really can have a role in fixing. So I think one talk that will be tomorrow that I'll be very interested in listening to will be the talk on PHRs. And I think personal health records make a lot of sense for a whole variety of reasons. Patients really should have access to their test results, labs, radiology, and cardiology in a very robust way. The no news is not good news really needs to be out there. If you don't hear about your test results, we did something wrong. You should be hearing about your test results. And it really does provide, at least we have good anecdotal evidence, that it provides a nice backstop for medical error. We don't have electronic systems in place that can track test results at the fine granularity that we need. But if we get those results to the patient, there's a much higher likelihood that they will get followed up on. Patients really do like these things, and they're incredibly popular at our organization and every organization that has a personal health record. I think this will kind of go poof in the night, and we'll spend billions of dollars if we don't pay attention to interoperability and standards. Right now, there's a PHR standards group in HHS that is trying to develop standards, but I really hope they kind of broaden the focus to industry-based groups to create these standards, because I really fear that we're going to be forced into a standard that will not be adoptable by the vendor community. So we shall see on where PHRs go, but I think they provide a backstop for medical error, and it's really where consumer-driven healthcare is going. So we've talked a little bit about sort of you're becoming a cost center and really thriving as a cost center. I think you thrive as a cost center by paying attention to quality, which reduces your costs. So we attack quality and efficiency rates. We build our systems around our frontline operations. We don't build them from the top down. What people, you really need people who are at the front line helping you build your systems. We make our process changes based on data. We build our infrastructure based on our frontline data that we need. And then we really stop doing rework and scrap. We don't try to reinterpret that manual test requisition when it comes to our laboratory. We don't spend time with our providers making sure their test got ordered. We don't make sure that someone actually looked at the test result. All that stuff, we build infrastructure so the system really tracks and improves that aspect. So now we're going to talk about the harder sell. And I was talking a little bit about this with some people this morning. The harder sell is laboratory utilization. And if we're going to think about cost control in the laboratory and what the pathologist's role is in controlling laboratory utilization, I think you want to focus on areas that, you know, are big contributors to the bottom line, if your goal is cost control here, high variability in clinical practice, and a lot of variable costs. So these areas would be sort of clinical laboratory testing and the blood bank. Blood bank utilization is a clear area that's, you know, very much in the heart of blood banking is blood bank utilization. On the clinical lab side, increasingly laboratory directors are being put under the microscope. I think we've all felt, had that email from our finance guys in the last few months, if not last few years, being asked to address utilization issues. And so can we turn to evidence-based laboratory medicine? And I would say absolutely not. Much of what we do in medicine, and certainly what we do in laboratory medicine, is not based on, you know, a mountain of evidence. There's very little level one evidence for very little of what we do. And even level three evidence, expert consensus. If you ask 10 experts how they would treat a very similar patient with a blood clot, you're going to get about four or five very distinct and different responses. So what occurs, and my wife's a hospitalist, so I know this occurs, and she tells me this occurs every day, the adage is, if it might work, try it, test for it. If it's a possibility that it could be, you know, part of the differential diagnosis, do the test for it. And the other sort of quote is, you know, if you can't show me level one evidence, I'm really free to practice at level four evidence. And so I'll order that expensive genetic test because I had a patient, you know, in my experience, this has been positive once when I've ordered it in the past. So I'm going to order it on all my patients because if it might work, I'm going to do it. So if it might work, I'm going to do it. This is what results in the long-term trend. So from FY02 to FY08, we've seen our reference lab expenses really explode at about a 12 to 15% annual growth. The rest of our expense base is growing at about a 6% expense growth per year. So why is this occurring? For us, it's occurring because we're getting a lot of very high-level practices joining our groups. We're getting pediatric genetics, pediatric neurology, people that are heavy users of genetic tests. And I think part of this is just success. You know, we've identified a lot of novel genetic risk factors. There are very useful, there's high utility of many of these genetic tests. But if you look at what's occurred, the line here is the percentage of the reference laboratory testing budget that is due to genetic tests. What you can see is that in FY02, we spent about $400,000 at Mass General on genetic testing. Just last year, fiscal year, we spent almost $2.5 million on genetic tests, consuming over half of the reference laboratory budget for a very small number of highly esoteric, highly expensive, poorly reimbursed tests that are, you know, of small volume, so are very difficult to sort of insource, the traditional model that laboratory directors use to handle these types of tests. What's very interesting to do is to take your reference laboratory budget and look at it at the provider level. So this is we have 1,000 providers on this graph. It goes off to the next state. But these are the high-level providers. This is how much reference laboratory expense they're spending per year. Of course, anonymized. But we can see our top 25 providers, A through Y, there's wide variability. And you can see it's mostly the usual suspects, pediatric genetics, pediatric neurology. This group accounts for almost a third of the genetic testing in our organization. So you have a very small number of targets if you want to go after this type of testing. This is the quickest way to, I think, lose your job and lose your relationships with your colleagues, is to attack them as using too much laboratory testing. So you really have to have a plan in working with utilization. We see, one thing you do see on this graph is that you have patients or providers in the same group, pediatric genetics or pediatric neurology, that have wide degrees of variation in the way they order laboratory tests. And variability in every other setting that's looked at in healthcare, whether it's TURPs, spinal surgeries, how often you see a cardiology, it's all due to geography. So who you see is what you get in healthcare. And it's very much the same, you know, at the individual provider level. Who you see is what you get. Process improvement in industry, variability is the absolute worst thing you can have in a process. So you're really setting a specification and then, you know, driving towards measuring how close are you to that specification. So how do we do this? How do we do this without, you know, becoming a pariah in our organization? So one way we do this is, you know, really apply Psych 101. We make it easy to do the right thing, exploit human nature, make it a nuisance to do the wrong thing. And we do this with our electronic order entry system. This is a big strategy for us in terms of controlling the cost, especially on the places where we have a high degree of control, our outpatient clinics that are very tightly associated with our hospital and our inpatient order entry systems. We really want to reduce decision-making, put a lot of reflexing protocols that Dr. Hawker was talking about, you know, make that really the standard. Make it a nuisance to do the shotgun ordering of tests. Make the reflex diagnostic algorithm the basic protocol. To do this, we have to provide real-time support. And we went and met with our residents before we rolled out our order entry project, and they basically told us, you need to tell me about four or five different things about a test result or about a test when I'm about to order it, and then I'll change my behavior. So building your process around the front line, once again, is really important. So what do we need? So to make this happen, what we really needed is something that our LISs couldn't offer us. What we needed is a different type of middleware, not that, that sits in the middle between the LIS and the analyzers that we talked about yesterday, but middleware that really sits between the LIS and the rest of the enterprise. We have a big problem with getting laboratory data to all the different consumers of laboratory data. You know, the enterprise decision support, outpatient, inpatient order entry, our own laboratory handbook. All of these things need to know about lab tests, and we don't have a way of cataloging the lab test, storing it once, and then maximizing the flow, those sort of lean concepts. So what we came up with was a way to sort of augment our LISs. So the LISs report to this PathConnect middleware, which is a very light level of middleware that just allows us to augment what we know about a test. So what we know about the CCP test, we can say, you know, what the ordering message we want to appear there, how we want to give a, you know, what tube type it is, how expensive it is, what the turnaround time is. All these things that our residents and our ordering providers told us were important, we're going to make sure we can supplement the data with our PathConnect middleware. So it really allows us to sort of aggregate and augment our LIS data and then share it with everybody in our organization and do it in a way that we don't think about it. It's an interface, you know, it's a service-oriented architecture that really has zero maintenance associated with it. So it's very basic middleware. Here's just one test, a CBC, but it just allows us to catalog the data so it can be shared with the rest of the organization. So one part of the cataloging that's really important is all those fields that our residents told us were so important. You know, they told us, you know, the ordering message was important, collection instructions. And so if you're going to build an interface, you have to be able to provide this information. And one thing that our order entry group told us very clearly is that they knew nothing about the labs. And the previous order entry module that was out there for 7 years before people realized that the lab tests hadn't been updated in 7 years. So we had tests that labs didn't do. There was all kinds of mistranslations. People would order a test that was, it was there 7 years ago when we set up the system, but there was no process in place to keep the system useful and up to date. But now we have this process to keep it up to date. We have the ability to define, you know, how people will search for things. So here they're searching for VIT-D or vitamin D, and we give them information. This is the information that our residents told us would make a difference. They wanted to know, you know, how quick is the test available? So we're looking at 125 hydroxy vitamin D, telling them it's really not the test of choice for vitamin D deficiency. People do read our ordering messages and do react to them. So we saw a drop-off in vitamin D tests that go out to a reference laboratory, and people will send the mass spec 25 hydroxy vitamin D, sort of the appropriate first-level screening test for vitamin D deficiency. Importantly, all this effort, you know, this would be a lot of effort if we were calling our order entry team every time we wanted to make a change to an ordering message or added a test code or added a new package or a reflex algorithm. We do this, 100% of this is maintained in real time by pathologists and laboratory people in the Department of Pathology. And we really provide the information that our providers request to be there. So building this screen completely with our frontline in mind. So back to utilization control. So a big part of utilization control, I think, is giving people good information. So giving them information about the test. That's not going to work necessarily with your high-end providers. So your pediatric geneticists that, you know about these tests, they feel they know, they probably, and very rightly, know more than you do about these tests. What I think has to be done in this case is really establish a shared baseline. So what we do is we meet with these provider groups, we discuss with them, you know, how they use the laboratory tests, and encourage them to adopt practice guidelines. Once you have a guideline, you can measure against that guideline for compliance. And then sort of in a very non-judgmental way, we can really understand, you know, why didn't you use the guideline in this case? And we can either update the guideline or have a discussion about it at our monthly pediatric genetics meetings. We're using report cards. I think you can really make sense of a utilization report card, not as a mechanism at this point, at least, for any kind of penalty, but really as a discussion point. You know, why did these children with autism merit this $4,000 workup while these other children did not merit that workup? And I think regular meetings with key provider groups is really the only way that you can successfully do this and kind of you know, keep your standing in the organization. So back to Dan's quote, I think the future is bright. We do need to focus on the frontline processes in information flow to really help our organizations. I think that the new chapter of healthcare, the incentives are going to flip. They're going to support groups that really provide high-quality, low-cost care. I think moving together as core laboratories really permits the system-level thinking that will allow these information management strategies to be adopted. And lastly, I think it's important to start lumping ourselves with cardiology and radiology and other parts of pathology as the information-generating processes of healthcare, because we all have the same problems. So the system should not be individual solutions, it should be an infrastructure solution at the healthcare system level. So thank you very much for your attention.